Today's Taisho will be on Case 40 in the Mumon Kan. Case 40 is entitled Tipping Over a Water Bottle. When Isan Osho was with Yakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook, of the monastery. Hyakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Taiyi, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, "You may not call this a water bottle. What do you call it?" The head monk said, "It cannot be called a stump." Hyakujo asked Isan his opinion. Isan tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. Hyakujo laughed and said, "The head monk loses." And Isan was named the founder of the new monastery. Mumon's comment: Isan displayed great spirit in his action, but he could not cut himself free from Yakujo's apron strings. He preferred the heavier task to the lighter one. Why was he like that, eh? He took off his headband to bear the iron yoke. Mumon's verse: tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Yakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet. So I want to, first of all, I want to thank everybody for coming here this morning on this beautiful fall day and for sitting so well. You know, we sit a lot. We sit for long periods of time without a break. And it even though that's challenging, especially for beginners, it makes a huge difference. You know, what often happens in the past, what has often happened is that people will come, say, on a Monday or Friday night for the beginner's night. And at first, you know, trying to get through 25 or 30 minutes of a sit or 35 minutes, it just seems like an eternity. I can remember the first time I did Zazen in a formal setting, and I was stunned that people were sitting for, I mean, actually, Genki Roshi, when he came from Japan, the sitting periods were 45 minutes long. That's what it had been at Ryotakuji. So he just started out at 45, and he realized people were falling over, so he made it 35 minutes. But for a beginner, 35 minutes was extremely challenging. And I can remember going to the Seattle Zen Center, and after about 25 minutes, thinking, I don't know if I can make it, you know, and being covered with sweat, you know. So it's definitely challenging to do that. And in beginners who come to our place also have that experience. You know, they would come here and sit, and they have a good motivation. They're here. They made the effort to come. But, you know, after 25 or 30 minutes, very difficult. And if they don't quit, if they don't just give up and they keep coming, you know, gradually that period of time becomes more and more manageable. And at some point, people begin to feel that they don't want to interrupt their sit. You know, so for many, many years, people would start on a Friday night or a Monday night and barely make it through, you know, but after about a year of practice, they would start coming on Wednesday because they don't want to interrupt the sit. And, you know, if you're not there yet, please don't worry. It just happens naturally. But eventually you get into that deep samadhi, deep mushin, right, where you know, your mind, you begin to enter this semi-thoughtless state. Even if you're having thoughts, they're not gripping you. They're going by. And it's like, you know, normally as we're going through the day, there's no space between ourselves and our thoughts. And the thoughts are triggering these emotional responses right away, you know. So as soon as you have a thought, you have, generally speaking, you can have very powerful emotional responses. And in the course of a day, you can be very high, very low. You can be very fearful, very feeling relieved. All of this goes on. When you come to sit, you know, you start watching the breath and you begin to calm down. After about 15 minutes, you have a deep relaxation response, even if you haven't been practicing very much. And, you know, towards the end of that 25 minutes of a first sit, your mind begins to quiet down and you begin to enter like an altered state of consciousness. You know, so the thoughts, there's like a space that opens up between you and your thoughts. And in that spacious emptiness, you begin to repose. It's like you're sitting in this place that's sort of an unmoving place. And the thoughts are going by, but they're not gripping you. They're not carrying you along. And you can see, you know, you see a thought go by. And, you know, especially if you've been doing this for a while, you're just letting them come and go. They're letting, and in a way, they feel rather impersonal, actually, you know. So, instead of experiencing the thought as who you really are, you're experiencing the thought as this transient phenomenon. It's like clouds blowing by in the sky. You know, if thought comes and it goes, and you're in this place that can feel and is indeed very unmoving, very unmoving. And you feel very grounded. You know, this is a deep samadhi. And one way to get into deep samadhi is to practice emptiness meditation. So we focus, once we're able to follow the breath out to the end of the breath, you'll notice that at the end of your breath, there's a blankness at the end, and a thoughtless state at the end of the breath. You can conceptualize it as existing at the end of the breath. It's actually always there. It's actually always there. But, you know, because we're so occupied with our thoughts, people go through their whole lives and never notice it. But, you know, if you're doing breath perception meditation, you begin to enter into samadhi, which means you're merging with your breath. And the thoughts become fewer and farther between, and they separate off from yourself. And you follow the breath out, and you get to this blank place, which is unmoving. And in one of the, and this is this unmoving place is really crucial to meditation practice. So there's, you can say there's two dimensions of our experience. There's this, the unmoving, and there's the unfolding, or this constant stream of events, and that includes thoughts and emotions. And when we sit down on the cushion, we ground ourselves in this samadhi, this motionless place. You know, we get deeper and deeper into that place. But it takes a lot of sitting to do that. And, you know, people who have been practicing for a while begin to appreciate the Wednesday night sits because you're sitting in that motionless samadhi, that emptiness, and you feel so grounded. And you know, the longer you stay there, the deeper your concentration becomes. It's like it's literally purifying your body, mind, and heart. It's like all of these karmic attachments you're gradually letting go of, right? And so, you know, what we've done today is really special because we've come here for several hours. You know, in some cases, we've been sitting for 4 hours, you know, in that grounded place, you know, and it's so refreshing, right? I mean, you know, we're normally like puppets on a string, right? We're like these puppets on a string. You know, you hear this on the news and you have this reaction, and you hear this on the news and you have this reaction, and you're, you know, whatever. And it's just so being able to ground yourself like this for an extended period of time is really like undoing all of those conditioned responses. Okay. So today everybody was sitting in mushin very deeply, very still. And the Japanese have this expression, forest bathing. It's where you go out into the woods and you take it in. And it is, it's so restorative, right? It's just, you know, if you go out for a walk and it's unspoiled parkland and you smell the fresh air and you hear the birds, it's like you're bathing yourself in this purifying medium. But actually, you know, this is even more, if I may say so, even more purifying, really more purifying, you know, going into this place. And, you know, sometimes you'll notice that the way you feel in deep mushin may be very close to the way you feel in nature, actually, you know, and that's not an accident. It's not an accident. That's very much the same experience. Okay. So when Isan Osho was with Yakujo, this is Wang Bo, he was the Tienso or Tenzo head cook of the monastery. And Yakujo wanted to choose a master, somebody to take over this or to take charge of this new temple, which is part of their system of affiliated temples. So he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Okay. So first of all, let me just say that any monk who wanted to do this, any monk who wanted to be the winner would be far from a good choice, okay? So this is really important. You know, in our culture today, in modern American culture, you know, competitiveness is thought to be a virtue. In fact, it's thought to be the virtue. So when people talk about somebody who has a drive or creativity, they often associate it with competitiveness. And, you know, it's a dogma of American life that competition makes everything better, everything better. But actually, you know, I have to say, as an individual and as a Zen teacher, I cannot agree. You know, I think that competition doesn't make things better. You know, I think that cooperation makes things better, right? You know, even successful competition has to have an environment of healthy cooperation, or it falls apart. So it's definitely the case that, you know, competition is not part of the Zen way of life, if I may say so. Because, you know, it immediately creates a split between yourself and other people. As soon as you find yourself in this mentality where you're trying to beat somebody else or best somebody else or better somebody else, you know, you're very far from an awakened state. You're very far from an awakened state. In this koan, you know, there's a bit of a koan, there's a bit of a hook or a bit of a you know, every koan has a kind of conundrum or at the heart of it. And the conundrum here is the idea that this is a competition. And maybe for the head monk, it is a competition. Because maybe he's too easily fallen into that mentality where you're trying to get the approval of others at the expense of others, right? The master is testing everybody, and he says, "We'll have a contest, and I'll see who is the most advanced in his Zen practice." And then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor. And he says, "You may not call this a water bottle. What would you call it?" Okay, so, you know, the head monk says, "It cannot be called a stump." So what he's doing is that he's providing like an intellectual answer to this question, right? the teacher has said, don't call it a water bottle. And the student says, okay, well, then it could be anything except a water bottle. And if I instead of saying what it is, I say what it isn't, right? I've helped people get free from the concept of a water bottle. I'm liberating people from ideas and having letting them have a direct experience of the water bottle. But actually, the head monk is still trapped in ideas himself, because when the teacher said, what would you call it? You don't have to call it anything. See, you don't have to call it anything. You can take the water bottle and throw it out the window. You can have any response with the water bottle you want. You don't have to be trapped by the master's language, see. So the head monk is trapped by the master's language, and the cook, the Tenzo, puts aside what the teacher has said and interacts with the bottle in a spontaneous way. He knocks it over. So he's, you could say he's escaped from the trap the master set for him by saying, call it something, right? He says he's acting in a way that's free from calling or not calling.
Okay.
And then the teacher, Yakucho says, oh, it's the cook. He gets to run the new monastery. And of course, we get a lot of references later on to like Mumon's verses, tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away. Those are like tools for cooking in a Chinese kitchen, right? You have ladles, bamboo baskets. So he's throwing away his stuff and he's making a dash for the new temple. That's the idea. So that's sort of like the textbook response to this koan. But of course, you know, if that's all there was to the koan, it would hardly be worth talking about. You know, today is an interesting day. Some of you may be following the news. But for the last week, we've been watching on television and listening on NPR to the COP26 global conference. Maybe you're familiar with this. But there have been 25 prior conferences on dealing with the problem of climate change, starting with the Kyoto Protocols back in the 70s. These conferences meet quite often. There have been 25 of them, I believe. And all the world leaders get together and they review the Kyoto Protocols. They have multi-level meetings. Secretaries of state arrive, presidents, prime ministers, and it's quite a big show. But you know, actually, a quarter century has gone by, and everybody was pointing out in advance of this conference that. Everybody was saying this is a make or break conference. Because in fact, you know, when I was young, there was already a conversation about parts per million of CO2. And in those days, the goal was no more than 350 parts per million of CO2. So actually, we've blown by that. That's old news. We will never again go to 350 parts. We're up to 100 more parts per million, and we're on the way up. The other thing that's happening is actually that CO2 is not going down, it's going up. And in fact, it's going up pretty dramatically. Atmospheric pollutants are also going up. So, for example, methane is going up. So we've been alerted to this problem since the 1950s. We've begun to do something on an international stage since the 1970s. And it's now, you know, basically a quarter century later, and not much has actually changed. It is true, you know, that the United States has seen its CO2 go down, not up. We have done some things, and the European Union has gone down. But we're still producing a lot of CO2, and globally we're producing more than ever. And it's really complicated, of course, because, you know, like in the United States, we produce less CO2, but that's because we do less manufacturing. And all the manufacturing is done in China. We buy their manufactured products, you know, so what we have done is kind of like exported our CO2 production to China, which is, and then we're saying you need to cut your CO2 production. So it gets very complicated fast. And the issue of fairness is a real problem. Lots of countries are very poor, and they say, you know, if we don't develop coal or we don't develop fossil fuels of some kind, you know, we can't develop, we'll be in poverty forever. So all of this is happening right now, and everybody was billing this conference as this event that where people would come together because they could see rationally, that something had to be done or our lives were at stake, see. And, you know, this conference had this huge buildup, and you had all the PR people out, and you had balloons, you had, you know, billboards. And, of course, it was rather interesting to see at the end of the week all of these people saying, well, we didn't really do what we came here to do. And in fact, I was listening to the news yesterday afternoon, and the woman from NPR was interviewing a diplomat who was part of the COP organization. And the interviewer said, well, so what have you accomplished? And the woman from the COP conference said, oh, that's a very hard question. And she came very close to saying we haven't accomplished anything. So I think this is really, I mean, I don't have to say this is really important, because everything they said about this conference is true, that our survival as a species is at stake. Possibly the survival of many species is at stake. And at least the welfare of hundreds of millions of our fellow human beings are at stake. And you can say, well, this is far from Zen, but actually this is really important, you know. Because, you know, if you're a concerned individual, and you read this, you know, one way to handle it is just to turn it off. I have lots of friends who just say, I don't watch the news anymore. I can't stand it. And it's hard to blame them after the last 5 years. And I was having a conversation with somebody who is a scientist. She's not an environmental scientist. But she was saying, you know, I just can't even talk about this. I'm so upset. And, you know, many people deal with this by just pushing it out of sight, right? So, because you have to, right? You have to. If you begin to take this all very seriously, it's like panic sets in, right? Now, you know, this is a big question, right? Global climate change. But it's actually so important because it's kind of a dramatic example of what we face all the time in our lives on a big scale and on a small scale. You know, so if you look at the situation with the climate and you see the numbers and they're saying, you know, panic, naturally you want to do something. You want to do something. So, you know, maybe you go to a protest, and I hope you do, you know, and if you go to the protest, that will be great. Please do. But, you know, you'll go to the protest. The diplomats will watch you protest. And at the end of this COP conference, they'll get in their planes and they'll fly home. And you will be left with a haunting feeling that maybe your protest didn't do anything. So, okay, so then you decide, I'm getting a zero emissions car. so you can get a zero emissions car. And that would be a good thing to do. Please get a zero emissions car. Or you get a Prius, a hybrid car. And, you know, maybe you try to consume less plastic, or you take, plastic bags, you take reusable bags to the grocery store, right? So all of that's excellent. And please keep doing that. Recycling is good. If you want to help, stop eating meat, because, you know, eating vegetables is so much better. But, you know, we do all these things and we still have a sense, right, that we aren't, that the situation is not responding to our efforts, right? It's like there's a disproportion between our actions and the way things are unfolding in the world. And right now, this is really like very dramatically on display. But as I say, you know, this is true all the time. You know, so I had a friend of mine. I've worked with her for 15 years. She's a highly capable person, and I love working with her. And in the last, during the pandemic, her husband, who had been working in his company for 25 years, was laid off, right? And their kids are just about to go to college, you know? This is not global warming, but it's a comparable situation, right? I mean, they have done everything they could. You know, he has like advanced degrees. He went to really good schools, you know. He's done everything he was supposed to do. And in this economic downturn, right, he was laid off. And it has, of course, it has huge ramifications. They live in Hoboken, where, you know, everything is super expensive. You know, they have two kids in college. This could not have come at a worse time. And you know, I was having coffee with my friend, and she was saying, you know, I lie awake at night and I just think, you know, I've got to make this work. And she said, you know, I laugh because they had a retirement plan that they've had to tap out in order to get their kids through college. And she said, now I realize I'm going to be working till I'm, you know, according to my calculations, I'm going to be working till I'm 85, right? So, you know, on the big scale and on the little scale, we have this experience of like uncontrollability. You know, we want to act, we want to do something, but sometimes it's not possible to do something. No matter what we do, it's not enough. I don't know if you've ever seen the movie A River Runs Through It. You may not have seen that movie. But it's a favorite of mine. I like the movie, but not everybody would like that movie. But it's basically about two brothers and a father who is like a Presbyterian minister out in Montana. And the father has these two sons, and you know, one is like, they're both really smart, and one is more cautious and. And, you know, the other son is more reckless and actually quite brilliant, right? And the older son eventually becomes an English professor, which is like a safe profession, right? But the younger son is a journalist, you know, and he covers city. He covers, like, I think it's Butte, Montana. He covers the city beat. And he has a lot of destructive habits, right? He drinks. He gets addicted to gambling. And the father sees like his younger son, who has all this promise and all this intelligence and talent, you know, sort of like skirting on the edge of self-destruction. And actually, eventually he gets killed. He gets murdered by some of the gangsters he's associated with. It's not about gangsters particularly, but it's about, you know, this father and his sons. And he can't stop his son from destroying himself. And he says, you know, we want to help. You know, I wanted to help my son, but I don't know how. Right. So it doesn't matter if it's global climate change, or it's losing your job, or if it's raising a child that you just can't get through to, right? You lie awake at night, right? And, you know, and rack your, my sister has an older son who's turned out to be a pretty nice guy, but, you know, he had his issues for a while. And my sister would tell me, you know, I just don't know what to do with this kid. You know, I don't know what, he wasn't as self-destructive as the character in the movie, but he was definitely, he was definitely worrying his mom, right? So this sense of, helplessness is really, can be very powerful. And it's not an illusion. It's not an illusion. It's actually the case in a certain way. In a certain way, it's an accurate perception of reality. You know, one of the, if you like those Marvel's universe, what are they called? Marvel Comic Universe, CMU. If you like Marvel movies, I'm happy for you. But, you know, these are fantasies of power, right? Fantasies of power. So, you know, Captain America was weak, and then these experiments made him strong, and then he was frozen in the ice and thawed out, and now he can fall off the Empire State Building, and he's okay. You know, it's great. But that's not us, right? You know, these movies allow us to identify with these superheroes. And we even say, I have a superpower. I have a superpower. But, you know, actually humans don't have superpowers, actually. You know, that's part of being human. We don't have superpowers. So you know, when we see something like the climate heating up, you know, I myself, I would love to be able to just like fly through the air and land in Washington and say, no more fossil fuels. It's over, right? You know, and then I could fly to Russia and say, no more gas to Germany. You know, it's over. You know, I'm calling the shots. But I don't have that power. I'm one of 7.5 billion people, or 7 billion people on the planet, you know. And I don't have much power, you know. And that's objectively the case. You know, and I could lose my job tomorrow too, just like everybody else. I could get cancer tomorrow, just like everybody else. So, you know, it's a fantasy to think, you know, I'm going to turn into the Hulk and tear this place apart, or I'm going to fly into DC and say, this is what you're going to do. You know, that's not going to happen. We're all watching this event. It's like being on a boat, and the iceberg is over here, and the boat is going here, and we're saying, stop the boat. But nobody knows how to stop the boat. Because if they stop the boat in a certain way, we'll all lose our job, right? You know, and nobody wants to lose their job. You know, it's very complicated, right? Nobody actually has the answer. The smartest people in the world don't know how to solve this problem. So when you don't know what to do, when there's nothing you can do, what do you do? And you could say, well, that's a hypothetical, but it's not. It happens to us every day, right? We have these fantasies of power, and our culture gins this up, right? I mean, Americans love this idea: is I'm going to change the world. Everybody's going to change the world. It's like, I don't know about it. I don't see that much change, right? You know, we love the fantasy of transformative such and such, but really things are very hard to change. Most of us experience helplessness regularly, and it may even be making you uncomfortable to hear me talk about this. You know, years ago, a woman came into the Zendo, and she'd been reading some books about Zen, and she said, "I'm here because I've just started a business, and I have a lot of stress, and I want you to help me learn how to meditate." So I taught her how to meditate, and she started coming. And then one day she said to me, "You know, is this going to help my business be successful?" And I said, "I don't think so. You know, it could be successful or it might not be successful, but, you know, it's going to help you deal with things either way." And she never came back, you know, there was a very famous Japanese baseball player. I think his name was Oi, Kenzaburo Oi. And Genki Roshi, in one of his, Genki Roshi was a baseball fan. Okay, so one of the things he used to talk about was, I guess Oi went into a slump. And he went into a Zen monastery to correct his slump. And Genki Roshi was talking about it in a Teisho. He said, you know, Oi went into a slump. He went into the Zen monastery. And then he came out and started playing again. And after the Teisho, somebody said, well, did he get to be better? And Genki Roshi said, no, he didn't get any better, but he felt better about it, right? This is really important, right? He didn't get superpowers in the Zen monastery, right? He didn't get Zen is not about superpowers. You know, but what can you do when there's nothing you can do? See, one of my teacher's teacher was a man named Shinichi Hisamatsu. Shinichi Hisamatsu is like a Zen master, but also like a philosopher. And this was one of his koans that he created. What will you do when there's nothing you can do? See, and this is where we are in so many ways. So, you know, the only way, or one of the only ways to deal with that situation is to stop living in your small self. Stop living in your small self, right? And you know, basically, that's where we spend a lot of our time, in the small self. And the more we spend, more time we spend in the small self, actually, I think, if I may offer my opinion, the more powerful becomes that sense of helplessness, believe it or not. You know, this is like the opposite of the way Western people think. You know, when I was a schoolboy in America, we used to write this poem that said, I am the captain of my ship and the master of my fate. See, when I was like 8 years old, I used to recite this poem. I am the master of my ship and the captain of my ship and the master of my fate. But actually, that's not true. And the more you live in the small self, the more you have to do, more work you have to do to push aside the fact that you are not the master of your fate and you are not the captain of your ship. So we have to sort of like live in a kind of dream state where we're having these fantasies of omnipotence or these, living in the, you know, Wonder Woman, the Hulk, Superman, you know, we're not the Hulk. We're not Wonder Woman. We're not Superman. So what do you do? And as I say, the more you cling to the small self, the greater will be your awareness on some level of your helplessness and your inability to change things. And look, why can't we just go, no more fossil fuels? See, why can't we do that? Because of karma. Karma, you know, Buddhists use this word karma, and karma means, in a way, it means history, things that have happened that lock us in to certain ways of acting or certain ways of thinking. So you know, I was listening to this woman yesterday, and she was saying, the person who was interviewing her, this woman from the COP conference, was the interviewer said, well, why aren't the people, the delegates at the COP conference, doing more to change this? And she said, because none of these institutions were created for this. She said, they're huge, complicated institutions. She said, 40,000 people came here to this conference. And she said, they aren't having big lunches. They're running around with their computers. They're arguing in rooms. But you know, at the end of the day, we have created these structures that don't allow us to address this problem, which has to be addressed yesterday. You know, even our own president, President Biden, You know, he can't make promises at the conference because he can't sell them to the American people. If he says, okay, no more coal, he's going to come home and that's not going to happen. Right? So he's trapped. Even the president of the United States is trapped and trying to change things and can't make them change. So look, what Shinichi Hisamatsu meant was, if we live in the small self, we will go crazy. We'll go crazy. And because the small self is the most constrained, the most trapped, the most powerless of all the selves we have access to. Right. You know. So basically in this koan, you know, the head monk was still living in the small self, actually. It seems like his answer is supposed to indicate that. You know, we may actually not be able to stop global climate change. Right? We may not be able to stop it. You know, you could lose your job tomorrow, and I hope it doesn't happen to you because it's a terrible thing. Right? One day you can be healthy like a tiger, and the next day you can be dead. You know? So living in the small self is like a bad idea. It's like a really bad idea. So you know, when we practice Zen, you know, we get out of the small self and we become part of something vastly bigger. This is what Hisamatsu meant. You know, what can you do when there's nothing you can do? You know, you stop being in the small self and you enter the big self. We say the big self. And the gate into the big self is Mushin, Mushin. You know, I have, when I started training at the Seattle Zen Center, after a while I began to get up in the morning and go to sit at Genki Roshi's place, which was next to the Zen Center. It was called Kugeon, his hermitage, Kugeon. And that's where we would have Zazen in the morning. We would have a bigger crowd in the evening, so we used the main Zendo, but we'd sit at Kugeon in the morning. And I would come into the Zendo and sit into the Kugeon Zendo, and I would sit down and I would sit on the cushion and think, oh my God, there's so much that I should be doing. I'm in graduate school. I haven't done all my reading. I haven't graded my papers. You know, why am I here? Why, this was such a mistake. It would be like morning after morning this would happen. And I'd be seized with panic. And I'd be thinking, if I don't get my PhD, I'll be, you know, driving a bus in Seattle, which is fine. You know, actually driving a bus, I've driven a bus, you know, but I was terrified. What will happen to me? I'll be on the street. I'll be, you know. And then I would just watch my breath, and I'd watch my breath, and I'd watch my breath, and I'd look over at Genki Roshi, who just didn't move a muscle the whole time he sat. He was just like, his face was like serene, and he never moved. And I used to sit next to him. You couldn't hear his breathing. He was just like gone. Kanon was on the altar. You know, every once in a while, I'd look up at Kanon. Guan Yin. And after about half an hour, I would feel so much better. I would feel so much better. And, you know, we'd sit for three sits, just like we do here. You know, I would feel so good. I would feel so safe and open and connected. So safe and open and connected. And, you know, my heart, you know, it might not happen every sit, but the more you practice, the more this condition of being becomes accessible to you. You know, where you're sitting on the cushion and you're thinking, oh, it's like everywhere I turn, I see danger and disaster. And indeed, danger and disaster happen to us. We're just one of, you know, we're one little human out of 7 billion, there are 7 billion people on Earth, right? And you know, the small self says, but I'm the most important one. The small self says, but I, out of 7 billion, I'm the one that really matters, right? And that's a fantasy. That's a protective fantasy. It's another superhuman. It's another Superman fantasy, right? Somehow I will beat the odds, right? I will beat the odds. We have those fantasies to protect ourselves from the implications of that state of mind, which are that we're totally vulnerable and powerless. But when we go into deep machine and we sit in samadhi for a while, we begin to purify body, mind, and heart. You know, we undergo this transformation. You know, at first we just feel safer. And then, you know, it's like when you're afraid, you close up, you get closed up. And we live, when you live in the small self, you live in that, it's like you're constantly ready for the blow, right? And, you know, after like a half an hour of meditation, you open the hand of thought, right? You open the hand of thought. You could say, oh, you're like, you start like this and you begin to get like this, right? Open hand. And you keep breathing and you keep going into emptiness and you begin to feel like connected to everything around you. You know, it's like if you've done a day of sitting, sometimes you can, like a half day, you go outside and you feel so fresh and it's like every blade of grass is alive. And if you come to sesshin, after like a sesshin, it's like everything is so alive. You're now not like this. You're now open. And when you open, you begin to connect, right? And, you know, the most powerful emotion people feel when they're in that state is, it's like gratitude. Gratitude. You know, so you start out like I see disaster and danger at every turn. You know, and sometimes, you know, people who live that way for a long time, they do commit suicide. It's an awful way to live. And everything seems to be threatening. But, you know, you sit down on the cushion. If you've made a practice of entering deep machine and you go into that emptiness, you begin to go through this transformation. And you begin to feel connected to everything around you. And you feel this gratitude. I am so grateful for my life. I am so great. I did not deserve this life. I am so grateful for my precious life. My precious life. The Buddha said that being born as a human is very hard. He said, people don't appreciate, there's 7 billion of us, so we think it's nothing. But the Buddha said, you know, actually, in all the beings in this vast universe, to be born as a human being is very special because human beings can wake up. And he said the chances of being born a human being are infinitesimally small. He said it's like a blind sea turtle swimming through the Pacific Ocean. And as he comes up through the water, he puts his head through a life preserver that just happens to be floating there. The Buddha didn't say life preserver. He said yoke, like a yoke they put on oxen. But being this a precious life, precious opportunity. And when we're in the small mind, you see those nowhere. But when you're in the big mind, when you're deeply in the big mind, you realize, you know, gain and loss, right and wrong, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. You know, the great Zen master, Xu Yun, empty cloud, you know, he used to tell this story about the emperor of China, Puyi. And Puyi was the emperor of China. So basically, he was treated very well. And, you know, there would be, when it was time for him to eat, there would be like 100 dishes. And Puyi would go through all the dishes and he'd take this lid off and smell, not today. You know, and then it would be Kung Xin Tsai. He said, oh, no, too much garlic, not for me, right? And then some, you know, and he'd take a little of this and a little of that, and then they'd take it all away and people in the palace would eat it, I guess. And then, you know, there was like a revolution and Puyi had to flee for his life. And he was sleeping in, farmers were smuggling him across the countryside, and he was sleeping on the ground on straw. And one peasant family prepared him a meal. They were sweet potato vines. Sweet potato vines are like, in China, used to be used as like a pig food, right? Because sweet potatoes grow a lot of greenery. If you try it, they're beautiful. You could plant them. And you could stir fry the vines. But in China, this is the cheapest, commonest like food possible. And Xu Yun said, you know, he had been starving. And somebody made him this meal of basically, you know, sweet potato vines, pig food. And he ate it, and it was like, this is so delicious. This is so delicious. So, you know, he was living in the palace. Nothing was good enough, right? Nothing was good enough. And, you know, actually, running for his life, you know, suddenly he realizes, oh my gosh, I'm running for my life. I'm freezing cold and I'm starving and everything is so precious. Now I see what an illusion I've been living in. See? So, you know, luckily we don't have to be running for our lives, right? And we don't have to be starving or freezing cold. But we don't have to live in the small self. And when we live in the big self, everything becomes precious. Everything becomes alive. You know, we're all vulnerable. We're tiny little creatures on a big planet that's in trouble, in a universe that's vast. We can't even understand it. And so, you know, living in the small self is a bad idea, especially because our lives are so short. You know, we can live this beautiful life. You know, and it starts in our path, it starts on the cushion. It starts with watching your breath. You know, and then, you know, when you're in that state of mind, when you're in that condition of awareness, it's like everything you do expresses your gratitude. When you act from competitiveness and fear, you can really do nothing right. But when you're in that state of gratitude, you know, thank you for my precious life. Everything you do is like the unfolding of the universe itself. It's like everything you do, you have the energy of the universe at your disposal. You become like Kanon, like Guan Yin with 1,000 helping hands. And when you stop thinking about yourself, you look around and you realize, oh, so many people in trouble. So many people need my help. And when you help them, you feel so good. So this is the Buddha's way. This is the Buddha's way. When Isan Osho was with Yakujo, he was Tenzo, or head cook of the monastery. Yakujo wanted to choose a master for Mount Taiyi, so he called together all the monks and told them that anyone who could answer his question in an outstanding manner would be chosen. Then he took a water bottle and stood it on the floor and said, "You may not call this a water bottle." So he set up a trap to see who would be trapped by small mind thinking. "What would you call it?" The head monk said, "It cannot be called a stump." See, so very small mind thinking. He's trying to win, actually, right? Yakujo asked Isan his opinion. Isan, he probably doesn't care. He's in that place. Oh, just to be alive, you know, just to be alive, just to jump. It's so beautiful, just to jump. You know, he tipped over the water bottle with his feet and went out. He's not gain and loss, right and wrong. It's become one with the universe, right? Yakujo laughed and said, "The head monk loses." And Isan was named as the founder of the monastery. Mumon's comment, Isan displayed his great spirit in action, harmonizing with the big mind. But he could not, he could not cut himself free from Yakujo's apron strings. Remember that when Mumon criticizes somebody, it's a compliment. The Zen style is never to compliment somebody because you don't want them to become egotistical. So you criticize. So what he's really saying when he says he could not cut himself free from Yakujo's apron strings, he means Isan had cut himself free from Yakujo's apron. He was now independently connected to the big mind. And he has now taken on a heavy burden. He used to just be a cook and all he had to do was put out the food. Now he's running a whole temple. So everybody's fate is in his hands, see? So he's accepting a bigger burden without fear because he's one with the big mind. He's helping others more. Mumon's verse, tossing bamboo baskets and ladles away, he made a glorious dash and swept all before him. Yakujo's barrier cannot stop his advance. Thousands of Buddhas come forth from the tips of his feet because his work is to help others